From the newsroom of Impact Alpha, I'm Monique Aiken, and this is your Impact Briefing for Friday, March 24th. Today, Robert Brown of Atlas Impact Partners and contributing editor Imogen Rose Smith joined David Bank to parse how bank failures and interest rate hikes have changed the dynamics of impact investing, perhaps forever. But first, here's what you need to know from the week in impact investing. President Biden exercised his first veto to protect a Department of Labor rule allowing pension plan managers to consider environmental, social, and governance risks in investment decisions.
I just signed this veto because legislation passed by the Congress would put at risk the retirement savings of individuals across the country. They couldn't take into consideration investments that wouldn't be impacted by climate, impacted by overpaying executives, and that's why I decided to veto it. It makes sense to veto it.
And it's shareholder resolution time again. This spring's annual meetings will feature votes on climate action, corporate political influence, and reproductive rights. Rhea Ventures has spearheaded 30 proposals on reproductive rights issues in the first proxy season since the Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade. Of the 542 shareholder resolutions filed so far, nearly one quarter call for greater climate action or disclosure. And happy, belated International Forest Day and World Water Day, which were both celebrated this week. In a guest post on Impact Alpha, Aaron Axelrod of Jonas Philanthropies argued that tree planting has gotten a bad rap. Once considered a simple and reliable solution to the climate crisis, tree planting has been sullied by sketchy projects, oversold carbon offsets, and exaggerated claims of greenwashing. The key to restoring credibility, Axelrod says, is the right tree in the right place under the control of local communities committed to local ecosystems. Jonas Philanthropies aims to grow more than 10 million trees this way by 2025. And water is becoming the new carbon. Investors are eyeing early-stage startups, corporate supply chains, public policy, and the muni bond markets for water risks and opportunities. Startups include Simple Lab, Varuna, 120 Water, and BioBot Analytic. Water-focused funds include Burnt Island Ventures and Echo River Capital. And the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued its final warning. Time is running out to stave off the worst effects of global warming. Now let's bring up Impact Alpha's David Bank, who's joined by Rob Brown of Atlas Impact Partners and contributing editor Imogen Rose Smith to assess the macroeconomic environment. Have a listen.
I have frequent conversations with both of you about how it sometimes seems that impact investors exist in kind of a separate universe that's kind of untethered from the real economy. I think that particular illusion became harder to maintain after the recent events at Silicon Valley Bank and across the economy recently. So we thought it would be a good idea to bring you in to just kind of say, what should impact investors now be thinking about in this new environment? Obviously, a higher rate environment, and then also just higher volatility in general. And I kind of want to make it that broad to the point of, you know, what's the new world that we're operating in, and how is it different, and what changes? Rob, why don't you just lead us off with some thoughts?
Sure. Happy to do that, David. Yes, the Fed has been very aggressive in raising short-term interest rates for, you know, about 500 basis points now. But the rate cycle is more complex than just the level of interest rates, right? Spreads are now, at least in the government markets, spreads are now negative, which we can talk about later, was really one of the drivers of the Silicon Valley Bank failure. Liquidity in the markets is much lower, and the velocity of money is much lower. The velocity of money is just GDP to money stock, right? How quickly is money turning over in the economy? And that is going to definitely affect the availability of capital, but it's also going to affect the cost of capital. That sounds obvious, I know, but not everyone incorporates that into their projections and assessments. And for impact investors in particular, my view is that that's important because many impact investments or projects are earlier stage and are no longer going to be valued with the same valuation metrics, nor at the same valuation levels that they were just a year and a half ago, which means they become less attractive, just purely financially. So I think that's a challenge that impact investors are going to have to take on board and face. You know, a simpler way to say that is every idea looks really compelling when interest rates are zero.
To build on David's original insight that sometimes it feels like the impact investing world is operating in a bubble and doesn't take into account outside events, do you think part of the reason for that is that not enough participants in the impact investing industry have much, if any, grounding in macro, in particular macroeconomics? And is it also potentially a reflection of the acceleration in growth we've seen in impact in a sort of post-2008 world, and that these macro factors, the last time you really saw a lot of these factors come into play was 2008?
That's a great set of questions, Imogen. To your last point, I would say definitely yes, but it's not just impact investors that have been blind to certain risks. The entire world has. There's no question about that. And I had been thinking for some time that the idea that we have, at least on Wall Street and in the financial markets, risk managers and others who are responsible for either taking or constraining risk, who have been for two generations watching interest rates go in one direction, was problematic. You know, not understanding how simple things like Silicon Valley Bank did not about duration and about asset liability management was pretty shocking. But I promise you, they're not the only ones. They may be at the extreme or may have been at the extreme, but they're not the only ones. And that sort of readjustment has to happen across the entire capital markets.
This is like every single time there's a crisis, this always strikes me about risk management, right? Like, because I feel like something happens and the risk managers are like, well, we didn't consider that risk. And you think, well, yeah, what the hell have you been doing then? Like, it was so shocking to me that like Bridgewater was like short vol going into COVID. I feel like risk management is, am I being unfair to say risk management should be more sophisticated than it is? Or is it just that you can't account for every single risk?
Wow, that's a hard one, Imogen. Early in my career, I had spent a bit of time, this was with Morgan Stanley, developing risk models, because again, I'd been trained in quantitative methods. And one of the lessons we never allowed ourselves to forget is that a risk management framework really isn't a number. It's a way of thinking about what you have today and the composition of what you have today and changes to that composition and changes to the output of the model. In other words, it just tells you whether you have more risk as you define it today or tomorrow, and whether or not you're even in the right ballpark. And I think a lot of that concept has gotten lost. It's about discipline. It's not about the risk models themselves. It's about your discipline in applying those models and your willingness to constrain yourself because you know something existential might happen.
But is what you're saying is that the risk factors are now higher, therefore, if all other things being equal, folks are less willing to make the investment that they might have made a few months ago because now it feels riskier. Therefore, things that would have been funded are not going to get funded.
I would absolutely agree with that, David.
And what kinds of things are most at risk of that?
Yeah, maybe by way of example, I would say, you know, if you're a public utility and you're thinking about funding a project to build an offshore wind farm or an onshore solar farm, your cost of capital just went up. Your assumptions about demand for electricity might come down a bit because you think there's going to be a recession, but you're probably going to go ahead with that project, right? That project is probably going to be something that you've got a 20 or 30 year model for. If you're a venture capital firm and you're funding the development of, let's say, early stage carbon capture technologies, you're probably less inclined to do that in this current environment because rates are higher and because uncertainty, to your point, is much higher. So that becomes much more challenging.
A lot of folks are kicking themselves or kicking ourselves, as the case may be, that there was this whole period, as you said, of extremely low rates when all kinds of infrastructure projects, you know, might have made sense. We could have made much more progress towards the sort of great green rebuild than we did. And now, oh, by the way, it's too late. We don't, you know, capital is too expensive. You know, sorry, can't do it.
Yeah. Although to that, I would respond just with a hard-nosed comment, which is there are a lot of great ideas that are really poor businesses. And a lot of those got funded at zero interest rates, so to speak.
So now we'll see which ones were great businesses.
That's right.
And then the other, I guess, truism is that if you do get funded in a bad environment, you can build a big business. You get to ride the uplift as the economy comes back in some way. So if you can get funded now, then you're probably in maybe not a bad business.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. You know, as the saying goes, when the tide goes out, you see who's swimming without a bathing suit.
Just take us then through the thinking. I mean, you know, I don't know. I don't want to make you necessarily, you know, yet another Fed pundit, but it has stuck in my craw that, you know, that in a time when, for example, the labor market, you know, is very tight and unemployment is low and wages had been rising, that the strategy that folks wanted to use to bring down inflation was to, you know, in a sense, undercut the power of labor. And it seemed to us at Impact Alpha that this rising power of labor actually was a good thing. So now, on the other hand, maybe it's more resilient than we thought.
I would say it's both, potentially. And the way we're thinking about labor right now is the following, that labor definitely has more authority and more power because labor markets are so tight than it had, let's say, a decade ago. Now, make no mistake, the labor market was also getting fairly tight even before the crisis. And opportunistically and constructively, what labor's been able to do then is force up their price. In other words, wages have gone up, which is a very good thing. What concerns me most is that is happening at a moment in time when we're probably going to see some economic weakness. And we're probably, if the Fed wins the battle that it's having with the economy right now, we're probably going to see an unemployment rate that rises a bit, and we're going to see labor that becomes potentially a little less powerful. And what I would hate to see is that dynamic sacrifice a potentially better outcome for labor going forward. And what I would prefer to see, rather than continued ongoing dysfunction between labor and capital, which some people would say could happen in an economy that's slowing, is I'd rather see that it's the time for labor and capital to be more constructive and be more of a collaborative engagement relative to where we were in the past.
Do you think that organized labor, like, what do you see the role of organized labor being in this discussion?
As a very important voice and as a very important advocate. And one that I think is, for the U.S. economy, increasingly dynamic with that voice.
A phrase that seems to be gaining some traction is fair gain sharing, in the sense that it is a function of the growth that can be encouraged, and then the question of how is that growth and the prosperity that ensues going to be divided, and it's kind of a pre-distribution, another idea that's kind of gaining strength, a pre-distribution idea as opposed to a redistribution idea.
I don't believe that the pre or post distinction is as important as the concept of labor getting more of its share. I'm going to stay away from what's fair. I think that's something that has to be hammered out at the negotiation table. But I do think the idea that labor has been underpaid for its contribution to success over the last couple generations, you might even say, is an important idea that rightfully should be addressed in the moment.
Okay, so we've got a labor market in flux. We've got an interest rate environment that's different than it was. We've got high inflation. We haven't even gotten to the war in Ukraine and oil prices. And we never even mentioned, I think you did in passing, COVID. You at Atlas Impact Partners are a hedge fund and you play it both long and short. All of this must keep you quite busy thinking about how it all plays out.
It absolutely does. And to be clear, we are a long, short, bottoms-up fundamental hedge fund. And our view of the world is that there are companies whose product or service changes the world for the better, and there are those companies whose product or service changes the world for the worse. And as all three of us have discussed, and as you have characterized as revenue materiality, David, we really do believe that that impact has to be the primary source of revenue for the company. We're not interested in making relativist comparisons between one company and a sector and another and who recycles garbage more or less in the cafeteria, right? That's not so interesting to us. What is very interesting to us is the idea that a company that is in the business of creating wind blades, for example, or is in the business of creating a better diagnostics test with greater sensitivity to produce improved healthcare outcomes for patients is changing the world, and that's all they do. So that's a long-winded way of saying we're bottoms-up fundamental investors, and the macro issues that we're talking about are really a form of, first of all, risk management. Because in order for you to be an effective investor, you have to understand what's coming. And it's also informing our fundamental decisions, right? If we have a decision to make about demand for rooftop solar in California, we really need to understand what the housing market is doing in California. And we need to understand what costs are in California and globally. And that's how macro informs our view.
So as an equity investor, how do you think about something like a Silicon Valley Bank or all of these other mid-tier banks that were, you know, to your point, doing good in terms of a lot of who they were lending to, including diverse entrepreneurs, you know, clean tech, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that was a source of revenue in their business that was effective, but they were mismanaging the duration in their portfolios. How do you look at that as an investor?
Not to be flippant here, Imogen, but I would look at it exactly as you just described it. They had a business model at Silicon Valley Bank that was highly effective as an organization. Lots of people in certain political groups have said Silicon Valley Bank failed because they were an ESG investor or an ESG bank, and they took their eye off the ball, which is complete nonsense, right? As a business, this was a highly effective strategy for them to go after a growing part of the economy. Frankly, as a bank, that's what every bank does, right? They try and find their niche where they can be either the deposit-taking institution of choice or the lender of choice. What failed at Silicon Valley Bank was shockingly really all about asset liability management 101. I mean, it was a failure of management. It was a failure of governance. There's more to the story to be written for sure. But this was just a bank that didn't do its job in constraining risk.
So, I mean, again, doesn't this speak to the idea that the G in ESG is important, right? It's not enough to just look at what a business is doing, the governance and how something is operates.
Absolutely. And as much as we support the concepts of E and S and G, I will say that any fundamental investor worth their salt has had a focus on governance for generations. That's not something new.
So were you looking at the banking sector as a short selling opportunity, or was it not on your radar screen?
The banking sector broadly, no. There is an argument to be made that earnings expectations for banks were too high, given the way interest rate dynamics have played out, and given what net interest margins were likely to change to, in other words, compress going forward. There is that argument to be made, but I don't see that as a wholesale short on the banking sector. That's just an opportunity to figure out who's doing it well and who's not.
I want to pause on what you said about the fundamental business of Silicon Valley Bank and targeting this high growth sector and targeting lending and support for startups and businesses. And you said that was actually a good business. And I think there are lots of folks now saying, hey, now there's a sort of opening there and an opportunity to pick up some of that business, either directly or sort of indirectly. But again, just to bring it back around to the sort of new environment, that business also is tougher now if rates are higher now, or is it not? Maybe it's a good business. You can lend to those companies, and if you're lending to the right companies, obviously you'll get paid back.
Yeah, I would say any business that is dependent upon capital right now, that in other words is not cash flow positive and self-funding in the moment, it's going to be harder going forward. No matter what your business constraints were, they just got a little higher. That's a broad generalized statement, but there's truth to it too.
Do you think that that's going to... So on the one hand, greater capital constraints are going to more negatively impact investment business, particularly sort of those, you know, run by underrepresented minorities and women, and people who historically have had less access to capital and found it harder to raise capital and to receive funds. Do you think some of the momentum that we've seen behind sort of the typical causes of impact investing is going to retrench?
So that deserves a careful answer. I would say the following. Again, anyone who needs capital in this environment is going to find it more challenging than they did yesterday. For those groups and those entrepreneurs and those business owners who have already faced the constraints that you just described, I think it's probably going to be even a little more challenging, which is a sad comment, and it's sort of an opinion more than a fact. But I do think everyone who needs capital is going to be more challenged going forward, and that'll probably play out unequally, unfortunately.
Rob, I think you've said that the impact investors and advocates who are trying to redirect large pools of capital that has thrived in a low rate environment of steady economic growth and stable geopolitics and favorable regulatory, that's all gone. So it's a new world now.
It is, yeah.
We're going to be navigating it with you, and hopefully you'll help us. And Imogen, as always, thank you both for joining us on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for having me. It's been a joy. If you'll permit me, I do want to give out a shout to the Climate Museum in Soho in New York City. If you have the opportunity during Earth Month, go head there. They've got some great opportunities for engagement.
And that's going to do it for this week's Impact Briefing. Thanks to Imogen, Robert, and David, and our producer, Isaac Silk. Ready to try Impact Alpha? Sign up for Impact Alpha Open, free of charge, directly at impactalpha.com. Want to go deeper? Grab a subscription and get full access to the site, Agents of Impact calls, and the daily email brief. Just go to impactalpha.com/subscribe and choose an annual subscription. Thank you for listening. I'm Monique Aiken, Managing Director for TIP, the Investment Integration Project. Be sure to check back for next week's briefing, and until next time, take care.